This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the return of, he is a producer with Morning Run at BFM, and he is Sim Wee Boon.
Hello, good to be back.
It's good to have you. He's also, which will be important for the purposes of this show, he's also a native of Sarawak. And more of that later. And also we have another return of after a very long time. She's a filmmaker from Sabah, and she said also, you could also call her an activist. She is Nadira Ilan. Ilana, sorry.
Different Sabahan.
Great to have you back. We'll ask you about... the work you've been doing. We'll plug that a little later as well. So our three topics this week is, topic number one is, do young people always feel the need to simply just beat up on the previous generation? Which is not my topic, actually. And topic number two is Sabah or East Malaysian viral content. And finally, topic number three is, what are the cultural differences between Sarawakians and Sabahans? And so with topic number one, Sim, we kind of did this actually on the show last week, but it was three old timers. So it's good. You used to be young until quite recently. So generational change, beating up on old timers?
Well, I wouldn't say beating up. Beating up sounds a bit like violent, I guess. It's more of like, because recently it's been going viral and a few articles been written about and been talked about. What I noticed is that like Generation Z, people from Gen Z are like just dragging millennials. You know, they kind of like are making fun of millennials. And it reminded me of the period where millennials were or still are kind of like dragging boomers and all the generations before them. And it got me thinking like, you know, are each generation just destined to like hate on the previous generation? So I kind of want to like, you know, talk about it and ask like you're obviously from a different generation than I am. And did you too drag like your parents or your grandparents' generation as well?
Nadira, you implicate yourself first.
Okay. I definitely understand Sim's sentiments at the moment. I mean, one with the politics, I don't have to go in there because everybody's talking about that. But I find that within the creative industry, there does seem to be a separation between like the veterans and the needs of the veterans as well as the younger generation. There's not as much investment I see in the younger filmmakers or artists coming up. And part of why I see that rift is because Malaysia is really bad with archiving. We don't archive our films well, we don't archive our music well. And so you get a lot of very frustrated veterans who still want to continue to work, who still want to continue feeling appreciated. But that unfortunate culture also makes it difficult for us for younger, you know, artists to come up. So yeah, there's an institutional problem with that.
Okay, so I feel like I'm going to be having to represent the veterans. but I'm young too. I've heard of Ludacris. I'm hip. Please. No, yeah, okay. I hear where you're coming from. And yeah, and I certainly, when I think back, yeah, I was really arrogant and impatient with, you know, the old timers. They were all so incompetent.
Which is the narrative that the current generation uses for the generation before them. You know, every generation feels that way about the older generation, and every older generation will feel that the younger generation is entitled, lazy, narcissistic. You know, it's just a repeating cycle.
But I think there is a difference, though, because I don't really remember. I certainly thought of the older generation as being incompetent in my way, and I'm a genius and I can do it. But I didn't really stop to think of them as being just morally corrupt. Sexually corrupt. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I think this is really part of the language now. And you know, their views on race, gender, etc. were abhorrent, but it was like, I don't think we really got too worked up about it. But now these are the yardsticks for judging the quality of the old generation. I mean, Nadira, I don't really know which kind of generation you would.
I'm Gen Z. Yeah. Like, no, I'm not Gen Z. Sorry, I'm a millennial. Yeah, I'm 33 this year. I mean, I don't know, especially in my industry, I feel that like it's really important to not put down the younger generation, and to, because I mean, of how the technology evolves. I think my issue isn't so much with elders, because I get a lot, I learn so much from them. But what I get frustrated with is the ones who are not aging gracefully.
They don't want to let go.
The people who are clinging to straws for like politics, I mean, or like in the political realms, or even in the creative industries, it's like a lot of my peers, you know, have just gotten married or have their first kids, and they're still not considered old enough, or you know, to be able to make decisions or be able to contribute to the creative industries. That is a real problem.
Yeah,
I mean, there's always a kind of like you haven't paid enough dues kind of thinking when it comes to that, right? Like.
There is, and it does become very problematic, because like where films are concerned, I don't see enough support for short films or understanding for, you know, like where young filmmakers have to start. The average age for a Malaysian filmmaker making their first feature film now is getting older, and I do think a lot of that is just because, you know, somebody told them, oh, you have to eat more salt or get more experience to be able to do that. Our young people, like, I'd like to see more risk taking. And more communication with older generations.
But surely with technology now, it is possible to risk take at, well, quite minimal cost. I mean, compared to my time, I had to shoot on 16mm, which is, I tell you, that's damn expensive.
But yeah, that's true. I mean, but because there's a division now, it's like, because you have YouTube filmmakers now, and then you have people who what I do. I'm a filmmaker, you know, and I want to target international film festivals and theatrical releases, but there are different skill sets altogether. Like it's, I don't know, but I still find that there's a lot of self-censorship to do with the culture of Malaysia. And that's where, for me, like, your generation is really interesting, especially because of like right now when, you know, while the lockdown was happening, I was seeing how artists of your generation were responding to things, you know, like with the whole, like, what was it? During Reformasi times as well, and how they would kind of like gather to, you know, do exhibitions, you know, in response to the politics of the day. And we don't have that, because Malaysian artists, our young artists, are too much about branding themselves instead.
Yeah,
you know, so there's a little bit to learn from both generations. They're just not talking.
Yeah, yeah. So Sim, you're 29 now, so you're not like young. Sorry, Sim. But
it's okay, I accept that.
Your 30s is the best. You're just not as confused.
Yeah, 50.
You kind of like know what you're going to do already, you know, like, yeah, all your hopes and dreams, you're like, oh, that was too far-fetched, I just want to live right now.
Yeah, so you, Sim, how do you stand on old-timers and young people as well? I mean, you've got young people around, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, you know, we've got like the interns in BFM, they think differently now, but I just think it's like a destiny kind of thing where it's a cycle, you know, you'll just keep on repeating, where the old people, you know, as you get older, there's a kind of like, I'm not sure if it's a saying or like something where, you know, whatever that you are born into, whatever technology that you're born into is like the normal thing, you know, you know, you accept it as the norm. And then between your 15 to like 35 is new and exciting. You know, you will learn, you will adopt, you will adapt it to your life, and you probably work in whatever this new thing is. And then after that, after you're 35, everything is just against the natural order of things. So, you know, and I think because of that, how things are set that way, generationally, everyone will just have the same reaction, you know. So, but what happens is, I guess, with technology, that it opens up information and it brings more people together. And that's why, like, again, we might kind of like think the older generation is incompetent or whatnot, and the older people might think that younger people are like lazy or whatnot. But I think as time goes by, there's less friction in that, because everyone will just, I mean, I think like as much as Gen Z will drag on millennials, when it's their time to be dragged by Generation Alpha or whatnot, the conversations about it would be very different. So right now, like a lot of, like what Nadira said, that a lot of young creatives now struggle with bridging the gap with like older creatives, because older creatives are still not willing to let go and not willing to kind of like let the way go for the younger creatives to come. And the younger creatives are like aren't talking to the older generation to learn from whatever they are learning. I think like as time progresses, like that gap will be like made much more narrower, because, you know, the language won't be so different. You know, they all will be from the internet age. They all will be like, we can make our own films and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. No, I, yeah. So I won't be put out to pasture just yet. Thank you. And
but I don't think that that conversation is going to be resolved until Malaysia actually starts to invest in archiving. It is a real issue.
Yeah, that's
like, if
we
go
true.
To the archives, no, because the thing is, like, it's true where, like, the younger generation, we don't really have an appreciation necessarily for Malaysian art history or even just like pop culture. It's not relevant, and those things are not relevant because we're not investing in archiving. And to the point where I think like last year somebody wanted to put in a policy where like older roles in film and TV, sorry, in TV in particular, can only be played by old people.
I read that. Yeah, it's crazy.
Which is ridiculous because it's not impossible to appreciate that generation, but we don't have the means and, you know, to be able to have them be relevant in our lives.
We have to move on.
Oh, okay.
If I can conclude Nadira's point, but also try to find older actors, people who've been willing to stick it out in the industry for that long, because it's ruinous trying to be in the entertainment industry. It really is. So we must move on. But just to say to young people, there's still stuff learned from the likes of me. I could tell you stories about Windows 95 and how to program a VCR. So
what's that?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you. So anyway, so don't kill me this way. So Nadira, move on to you. Topic number two: viral content. You have shown us some viral content, which is really interesting. What from East Malaysia?
Yeah, okay, so I'm a filmmaker, and most of what I'm targeted is, you know, for international film festivals as well as theatrical release, but it's a very different ballgame compared to sort of like YouTube filmmaking and like a different skill set altogether. And one thing that I've been sort of observing a little bit as of late, because within the Malaysian film and TV industry, it's still very peninsula-centric. And then East Malaysian content is getting absorbed into the Malay market. So it's still being told by Peninsula Malaysians, even the Kamatan and Gawai ads in telemovies, which is quite frustrating for cultural, but also economical reasons, you know. But then, you know, like during this lockdown and this time where I was questioning, you know, for 3 months, it's like, oh my God, can I still be a filmmaker? little pandemic paranoia set in. But then at the same time, you had like this little girl, like Audrey and her father, and she's like about 4 or 5 years old, and she did this cover of Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name of, that got a million-ish views. I can't remember, I'm not sure how many views, but then like it got picked up by Tom Morello, who's the lead of Rage. And then more recently, in the last couple of weeks, people have been going insane over Viviona Mwasubin, who is this university student in Sabah who went up a tree, stayed there to get a good internet line so that she can actually take her exams. And I just saw yesterday that she's hit 100,000 subscribers. The Sabahans who have the most subscribers that I know have about 113, 116, and that's after years of doing it. So what's exciting to me is that I know just by looking at the numbers on YouTube that there is a high demand for East Malaysian content. There's a short film as well by this primary school in Sabah, SK Tampulan Telipok, that got 21.5 million views for a zombie short film, you know? And then now they're starting to get, you know, awards in Brazil, you know, for their students, you know, participating in this international film festivals for kids. And it's just like, and I come back here and KL is still kind of like, oh, we don't know what other Sabahan filmmakers there are besides you.
can I ask?
But not even that. They already think that they still have like that warp thinking that we're all like East Malaysians are like kampung and, you know, there's no roads there and whatnot.
But there is systemic racism that goes with it, because what I've studied is that like in 1983, because in Sabah and Sarawak, we already had our own radio. We were already doing our own documentaries in the 70s. You know, but then by 1983, TV2 came to Sabah and said, hey, for budgetary reasons, you guys don't have to produce your own content for 20 years. So for 20 years, the generation before me, I'm not the first Sabahan filmmaker, but just the generation before me knew that, you know, like in the time like come, you're saying you're shooting a 16 mil and all these things, like these are not easily accessible to people. The generation before me was not allowed to produce their own TV and film programs. And now people can from KL can look at us and say that, oh, you know, like you're backwards, or, you know, you have so much to learn from West Malaysians and that kind of thing. And I find that quite offensive because it's systemic, clearly. But YouTube says otherwise. YouTube says there is a demand for this. What's going on?
But can I ask a question then to jump back to something you said earlier about this zombie film made by a school?
Yeah, primary school.
Primary school. And you've watched it?
I programmed it for Tayangan BMW Shorties at Urbanscapes last year.
Right. And so was it set in Sabah? Was it a Sabah based story? So identifiably Sabah characters and the like.
The title, Tuhao versus Zombie. Tuhao is like our, you know, like traditional food. But it was also done for Sabah Screen Fest. So there's also a there's a short film competition for primary and secondary school students that includes short films and animation. But this is where I'm saying that like East and West Malaysia are not talking in terms of our industries, and that needs to happen.
Well, but can I ask another question then? So you say that you do work with a view to international film festivals. Mm-hmm. Is it not also that international film festival curators, judges, and audiences look upon you as a Malaysian filmmaker and expect Malaysian content, whatever that may be? I mean, do they not also impose upon you a need for it to be exotic? Something that they can kind of hang on to. They can sort of like, oh, jungles.
I get that more in KL. Like in KL, like they really want to see the exotic side of Borneo. Unless we're puking hornbills, they're not really interested in us. Hmm. But when I'm actually overseas, usually when I do my pitches for my stories, for my markets and that kind of thing, I will tell them it's like, what you know of Malaysian cinema is actually Peninsula Malaysian. But I come from Borneo. And it is something different that I am indigenous and I am a woman. So the things that are the big chip on my shoulder here are actually stories that they're more interested in. So the international community by now, you know, are pretty excited to sort of see what's coming from East Malaysia, to the point that Singapore Film Festival, you know, like emailed me 1 year and they were not asking for Malaysian stories. They were asking for stories from Sabah because they know what my agenda is and they acknowledge it.
And Sim, have you ever seen a recognizable Sarawak story on film, something that you go, oh yeah, I kind of get that. I know, I understand these people. I've seen that.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say kind of get that, but I think the screen time for a lot of Sarawakian content, especially me living here in West Malaysia, is not there. Not, you know, it's not exactly like what Nagira said, you know, when you kind of like show like Tourism Malaysia has an ad on like Sarawak, it's, you know, it's kind of warped, you know. I mean, I can recall back there was this whole thing about there was like an Astro movie, or I can't remember what movie, that was being shot about Sarawak, and they would hire West Malaysian actors and then have to teach them how to speak Sarawak Malay
every time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, why don't you just hire a Sarawakian actor? There are plenty. I mean, and just to make a point, like the most famous male actor internationally now, he's half Iban. So, you know, like, yeah, I mean, it's just,
Henry Golding.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, you know. And there was this pivotal moment where he was on Ellen DeGeneres and, you know, people asked him and he doesn't introduce himself as like half Malaysian. He goes like, I'm half Iban, you know. So there's this type of, these are things are what I noticed as well. Like, you know, I think what Nadira says is right in the sense that like in West Malaysia, you get more of that fetishization of like, you know, that fetishing of, you know, you're from Sarawak, you're from Sabah, you know, you must look like that, you must live like that, you must speak like that, you know, tell me about like these very stereotypical assumptions that you have of like Sarawak and Sarawakians.
Okay, Nadira, can I conclude by asking you cold hard economics, right? You know, to make a film, you need an audience. An audience have to pay for the product, want to pay for the product. Mm-hmm. You seem to be talking about a Malaysian audience wanting to pay to go see a Sabah story.
Yeah, but I mean the culture of the way that we consume content in Malaysia ultimately needs to change, because I understand when people sort of say, well, it's not that I understand, but there's this logic that says the Malay market is the biggest market, therefore that is what we cater to. And then when we look at the population in Sabah and Sarawak, they're a minority, so we shouldn't make content that's just for them.
Yes, but the Malay language, people have to speak in a language on screen that's understandable.
Well, I had to have my indigenous language taken away from me in order for me to speak Bahasa Malaysia. I got Malaysianized, so I can't even speak in a Bahasa Sabah accent without being chided by my boss, or even without the broadcaster telling me that if you speak in a Sabahan accent, even if it's Baku, we need to give you subtitles. There is an inherent racism that is here that we need to address, that has to go beyond our statistics and our numbers. It is, you know, being able to sort of reimagine Malaysia. You know, we didn't even get to do that. We're the last government to reimagine Malaysia. We were talking about the MA63. So just by default of having lesser populations in Sabah and Sarawak, suddenly we're not allowed to have content that is ours. And how that is, that is damning, is because then we don't have ownership over, we in Borneo don't have ownership over the Malaysian narrative. And to me, it's just stupid, because the thing is just like, we can tell the difference between, you know, a Malay person and a Kadazan Dusun person. And if you go do a full feature film with Malay people playing Kadazan Dusuns, when we had our native languages and our cultures and our heritages taken from us, it is racist. It's not the right thing to do. And to be honest, it's boring. It's really boring.
Well, I don't want to come across as being the arrogant, out of touch West Malaysian cutting you off, but we do have to move.
How dare you?
we're already over time on part one, but in a moment, though, we're going to talk a bit more about Sabah and Sarawak here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Sim Weeboon, and Nadira Ilana, who are both East Malaysians. And so this topic is very much about East Malaysia, because I, for a book project, I've been having to do a lot of research on Northern Borneo, pre-colonial and colonial Northern Borneo, not post-independence. That is all still a complete mystery to me. But in the research, I've come across many surprises and wonderful surprises. It's a really fascinating part of the world. But a couple of things that came across that really kind of struck me, I'll just mention one from Sarawak and one from Sabah. With Sarawak, I've done over the years actually a lot of research on Sir James Brooke. And so when I was in the Sabah State Archives just before the COVID-19 lockdown. And I would see mentions from the British North Borneo side of appearances from the Brookes, because his nephews and descendants took over in Sarawak, and the Brookes would kind of like flitter in and out of the story, but they seemed very mysterious. And because it struck me how actually essentially Sarawak was an independent nation for 100 years before Malaysia ever existed. Sure, it was under a British guy or a British family called the Brookes, but they ran it independently of the British Empire. They came under the protection of the British Empire. They wanted that desperately. But once they got that, the British took very little interest in what happened in Sarawak, and it was run independently of anywhere else in the world. And I kind of wonder if there's a streak of, you know, the sort of memory of independence that lives on in the Sarawakian imagination. But before I ask Sim that, with Sabah, something that really struck me is that both these states are cut out from Brunei. But Brunei in the mid-19th century was really down on its luck. And so Brooke was able to take Sarawak, and a large portion of Sarawak was taken from Brunei, but also from the Sultanate of Sulu. And this is something that really makes, I think, Sabah very different from the rest of Malaysia. Although a lot of the British administrators in what was essentially a company, was not part, theoretically, of the British Empire. It was run by a company as a business enterprise. But the administrators, because I know their names now, they were all from West Malaysia. They were the same characters who ran the sanitary works in Perak, ran Perak itself, would then go over and work in Sabah. So it was very much linked in with the mindset of the peninsula. But something that really makes a difference is that Sabah also faces eastwards. Until very recently, the largest city in Sabah's Santakan, which is facing eastwards and into the Sulu Seas. And the Sulu Sea is this sort of colonial Bermuda Triangle where...
That's a nice way to put it. It's an interesting way.
Because it's like the Spanish never really controlled it. The Americans never controlled it. It was never the Dutch. The British never... It's just an area that even to this day has a real independence about it. And Sabah looks into that sea and that world in a way that the rest of Malaysia does not. I think the rest of Malaysia is Straits Malacca based and also South China Sea facing. But that Sulu element, that kind of wild east quality, I think also gives Sabah a difference. So I don't know. Some of the things that I, as an outsider looking in archives, as opposed to necessarily walking the streets, the sort of things that I've noticed. What do you two think? Nadira, perhaps start with you.
My grandmother grew up in Sarawak, and then I have a fair few friends there. But I'm interested in talking a little bit about it because Sarawak seems to be very untouchable because there's so much Sarawak pride, and they're so touchy about people talking about their history and their politics because they said that like you don't understand. A little bit, but it's because Sarawak is very complicated in the sense that you have the Brooke family. How I think that affects people today is that, which I find really annoying, is that it's really hard to criticize white privilege in Sarawak. Sarawak is like this dead zone for talking about white privilege because of the Brooke family. And I think that this is like, I don't know. But yeah, that's one thing that I wish that Sarawak would sort of like kind of figure out. But to do with Sabah, yes, you're right. It is interesting. It's a Sulu Coral Triangle, actually. That's what it's called. So this is what's really interesting and about my work, I guess, as a filmmaker, is that because there's a huge difference between social consciousness and politics. Yes, you are right. Sabah does face, the Sulu Seas. A lot of people don't know about the cultural connections between, Sabah and Mindanao. Mindanao doesn't know about this. I went to Mindanao to travel last year, and like this guy met me and he was just like, "You're from Sabah? There are people there?" Because all they knew about is just like, and the funny thing is like there were so many common words. I mean, I'm not fluent in Dusun, but I know some words. So just between, the languages between the Mindanao and the Dusun Dayak languages were very close. And I was like, oh my God, I spent 10 years trying to convince people in West Malaysia that we're part of this country. And it's just easier for me to culturally assimilate with these people. And one thing that I do like about the whole international film festival circuit is that we sort of work as unofficial embassies for one another. And so I learn a lot about what happens in Indonesia and Philippines through those stories. And I wish that we actually had more access to them in Sabah, because now you're seeing growing rates of xenophobia. Ketuanan Bumi Putra is the new thing after Ketuanan Melayu. And that's bringing a whole new wave of bigotry to Sabah politics that we need to counter through representation and sharing films and stories amongst these parts.
Sim, differences?
I do agree with what Nadira said about the white privilege kind of thing. I think what happens is that like a lot of the thinking is that the historically painting of the Brooke family is not as negative in terms of like what the current situation is, where a lot of the problems that Sarawakians face is because the West Malaysian federal government is like, giving us a problem. I mean, whereas the Brooke family helped somewhat modernize Sarawak, they've been talking, I guess that's that kind of like that leftover
romantic after effects.
Yeah, romantic memory of it. Yeah, so when that happens, it translates to that, not to say worship, but it's like, oh, they're fine, and white people are fine. But it's the West Malaysians that, are really doing everything that's bad,
so
And I get where that comes from, because, like when I was growing up, I mean, like I'm from Sarawak, I grew up in West Malaysia. I grew up here, I went to school here, and, the type of stuff is like, oh, you're from Sarawak, do you guys eat dogs, or, do you live in trees, stuff like that. Like, whereas, like, you know, when I was going to college and I meet like people from Australia, people from Norway, and they are like, you know, the whitest of the white. And when they ask me about where am I from, and I say I'm from Sarawak, which is different. It's not in West Malaysia, it's in Borneo. They don't go like, oh, you live in trees. They go like, wow, tell me more about that. You know, like, so I guess that's that kind of like, that those tiny things that translate to much more bigger things. Yeah. And there is a much more like, from the Sabahans that I met, my girlfriend's half Sabahan. And, you know, like the different Sabahans and different Sarawakans I met. I think that Sarawak pride is like, you don't hear Sabahans talk about Sabahan pride as much as Sarawakans talk about Sarawakan pride. And there's a language
to
it. You
need
to
be around
well.
More Sabahans.
Yeah, probably. But the intensity as well, you know, like the way that it's been described, at least that's what I noticed. Like, you know, when Sarawakans talk about Sarawak pride, it's more intense. It's more, I wouldn't say like they're ready to pick a fight, but you know, it's like, it creates a sense of like, you really can't talk bad about Sarawak, you know? And I guess that kind of like, yeah, that makes discussion very hard, because if you are going to educate someone about where you're from and about your state or your legacy, to start off being kind of aggressive about it probably will push people away as well, as ignorant as they are probably to begin with.
So that's what I find is dangerous about Sarawak, and I love Sarawak, you know, but there is it for me, I always criticize the way that history is written and history is perceived, because, you know, growing up in Malaysia, we know, especially as East Malaysians, how much we've been absolutely brainwashed. And the fact of the matter is that not everybody in Sarawak actually, you know, like, has fond memories of the Brooke family, you know, like, and I think it is, there is a danger, I suppose, in romanticizing your history, because you're not able to sort of really find a new identity for yourself. And when you get screwed over by your own people, thing, you know, like, you, it's very hard for you to criticize outwards, because the thing is, like, the Malayans become the boogeyman, you know, and then you don't get, and then you always end up with superficial conversations, you know. And I think that Sarawak deserves much better than that. Yeah, so when I was studying in Australia, there was this white guy who found out that I was from Borneo, and then he was really excited about the Brooke story. This must have been in like 2009 or something like that. And then he said to me that, oh, he was interested in writing the script with me, because he said that, isn't it fantastic, you know, the Brooke family, because he knew that they migrated to New Zealand and Australia, like his descendants have. And he said, isn't it an amazing story, because it's a story that bypasses racism. It's a story about how a white man can go over to Borneo and rule over it, and nobody thinks lesser than him, and nobody calls him a colonizer. But the Brooke family, I mean, are not colonizers, well, because they're profiteers, just as Cam said. But I thought it was pretty disgusting that, you know, a white man said that, like, how wonderful it is, I can, like, you know, take over these brown people's country and not be criticized for it. And there's a movie coming out about Raja. This now.
Yeah, which, so I kind of dread watching.
It's going to be interesting seeing how that film does internationally in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I mean, we can talk about this for ages, because it's a fascinating topic. But I've really enjoyed reading the history, and I have to read yet more. So, but we must move on, and we move on to the last part of the show. Recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest, and Sim goes first.
Yes. So, in light of the topics that my fellow guests have picked, my recommendation is something called BorneoDictionary.com. So, I mean, as it sounds like, it's a dictionary for a lot of the languages and, you know, dialects that are spoken in Borneo. And it's like, like my friend introduced me to this. My friend in Sarawak showed me this, you know, and they really like catalog, like, you know, all kinds of languages spoken, from Bembawang to Kelabe to the very different types of Bidayo and Iban. And it's actually started by this guy called James Graham and Amalin Ayok. So James Graham is, he had another website before this, which is called On This Day, which is a historical website as well. So there's a lot of, like, you know, history put into this, and I think it's really cool.
BorneoDictionary.com. BorneoDictionary.com. Okay, cool. All right, check that out. And Nadira, what is your recommendation?
Ooh, I was going to mention something else, but I think I'm going to play off Sim's recommendation. So I would encourage people, listeners, to look up the Borneo Literature Bureau. And so the Borneo Literature Bureau was the first publishing house, at least in Sarawak. And we're coming from oral traditions, yeah? So North Borneo and Sarawak had our first generation of print literature. So we were doing our own like poems and folklore and things like that in multiple languages. But in the 1970s, after the National Cultural Policy, yeah, a lot of those books were burnt. And you can go to the Tunjuga Foundation and they have a collection of their books under lock and key.
So what is it again? Sorry?
Borneo Literature Bureau. Borneo, so it's a publishing house that started in Sarawak. Yeah.
All right, cool.
Okay. And had their books destroyed in the 70s. Plenty of, yeah, this, okay, look it up. It'll be interesting.
History being erased, Cam.
Yeah, that would be me. I guess I did that. As a boomer or as a West Malaysian, I don't know. My recommendation, I wanted to choose something Sabah Sarawak. And as I was thinking about, you know, my experiences, I really like, as you say, Kuala Kangsa, Kota Kinabalu. I really like it. But if I was to choose an experience that I had in East Malaysia that I think is really special, it's something I've recommended before, but I was reminded of it during MCO, is the Mulu Caves. As a tourist destination, I think it's easily the best thing I've done in Malaysia. It's so well managed and curated. And to be inside those caves is astonishing. They're so large. And then at the very last part, you sit down this beautiful little amphitheater to sort of watch the bats emerging for their evening feast. And I was sitting there thinking, well, this is not much of a show. And then there was nothing happening. And then suddenly, oh, that's a lot of bats. and it was really, it's an epic moment of nature. So I don't think I've seen that many creatures other than human beings in one spot ever. So the Mulu Caves, I really loved it. So Nadira, before we go, Nadira, are there any film things of yours that you would like to tell us about that we should check out?
Well, I am in the process of finishing my most recent short film, and it's called Padaw Om Buhan Kopi So Omo, or in the English title, it's Where the Sun and the Moon to Meet. So you can follow me on Nadira Ilana Patbising, which is my Facebook page now. and then I'll be posting updates on that film as we send it to festival.
Okay. Sorry, what's the English title again?
Where the Sun and the Moon to Meet.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so that's a prologue to my feature film, which is excellent. Set in KK.
Excellent. And Sim, well, we whatever, you know, your Facebook.
BFM.my.
Yeah, okay. So, thank you both, Sim Weeboon.
Yeah.
And Nadira Ilana, thank you so much. And myself, Cam Raslan. And so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.